your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. My guest today is Sanho Tree, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he has spent nearly 20 years devising alternatives to the war on drugs. A military and diplomatic historian by training, he studies the impact of the drug war on Mexico and around the world. 2 weeks ago, the administration leaked that Pennsylvania Congressman Tom Marino was in the final stages of vetting to become the nation's drug czar, the head of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Donald Trump promised a harsh and punitive drug policy agenda based on police, prisons, and the military, and his pick of Marino is certainly in keeping with that. Even Trump's border wall with Mexico is billed as a hermetic seal against narcotics. Trump inherited an opioid overdose crisis spiraling out of control. The government had already cracked down on pill mills, and prescriptions for drugs like OxyContin had been falling since 2012. But shuttering the pill mills drove a huge cohort of opioid addicts to heroin, and now the heroin supply has been poisoned with extremely powerful synthetic drugs like fentanyl that can kill in minute doses. In the last couple years, morgues from Cleveland to Vancouver have been filled to capacity by waves of tainted heroin. Sanho, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
There's a veritable alphabet soup of agencies that oversee U.S. illicit drug policy. Can you give us an overview of how they all fit together?
Well, they don't really fit together. That's the problem. The idea back in the 80s when they created the Drug Czar's office was that there would be, you know, one ring to rule them all, so to speak, right? One coordinator that would, you know, crack heads together, coordinate policy and have budget review authority and stuff like that. Except instead of making it an impartial, outside independent agency, they put it in the White House. So it's called the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. That's the Drug Czar's formal title. And so instead of taking it out of the political context, they politicize the office beyond all measure. So it's a reflection of the administration in charge rather than data-driven or evidence-driven policy. And so politicians like to use the Drug Czar for posturing rather than actually solving problems very often.
Does the Drug Czar give orders to the DEA?
They won't say exactly, you know, how they coordinate all these things. They do have budgetary review authority, but they fight fiercely to protect that right, but they don't really use it, which is really maddening. They cajole, they talk, you know, they persuade to coordinate various budgets and stuff, but, you know, everyone's got their own piece of the pie, and each agency will fight to the death, and they have their congressional defenders and committees and subcommittees that will back them up on this for their budgets. So basically, once you create a bureaucracy or a sub-agency or whatever, it's very difficult to take the money away from them and reprogram it for something else. You can add money to other agencies, but it's hard to take away.
What do we know about the Drug Czar apparent, Representative Tom Marino?
Very problematic, kind of a real mixed record, as so many appointees under this administration. I mean, and I'm not just saying that because it's a partisan thing. I'm just saying it because objectively, there are a lot of questionable activities in his past in terms of people he's helped and industries that he's favored and you know, made it harder for to get traction on the opioid crisis in some ways, gone after drug peasant farmers in Colombia and places like that, which will have zero effect on. It's the most useless part of the equation to fight. He's helped when he was elected district attorney in Pennsylvania 20 years ago, helped try to get an expungement for a friend of his for cocaine dealing.
Wow.
So this guy has been all over the map. It's a very, very problematic track record. I'm sure this will all come out during his confirmation hearings.
I was kind of interested. People are saying that he was helping the drug companies because he co-authored that piece of legislation that makes it harder for the DEA to shut down pharmacies. But is that really a bad thing? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of punitive actions against drug companies that hurt legitimate pain patients.
Yes, absolutely. So there's two things. We have to separate the policies from the conduct. The policy of shutting down, you know, a lot of these prescribers is very problematic when you already have a huge population that is dependent on these opioids. Because if you try to tighten, you try to cut off the spigot now, that will force people into the illicit black market, where they will buy heroin, which is much cheaper, and you don't need a prescription, and that sort of thing. Versus doing the bidding of industry, which really isn't, you know, isn't doing it from a protection of protecting patients or public health or harm reduction, but rather maximizing profits. And I think he's been a servant to industry rather than having the bottom line be public health. So from my point of view as a harm reduction proponent, you know, we need to be very careful about these knee-jerk reactions from DEA and other places that think that the solution to every problem is to get a bigger stick.
The Trump administration is now promising us both a drug czar and an opioid czar in the form of Chris Christie. How's that supposed to work?
Well, there's Chris Christie and there's Jared Kushner, which, you know, Trump has also tasked him with solving this problem as well. So who's that authority?
And Kellyanne Conway decreed herself queen of the opioid crisis, too.
Yeah, exactly. So what's the point of having a drug czar when you've got a family member who's going to have much more clout, or two family members that have more clout in reaching the president, and you've got a drug czar on top of that? So who's really in charge? I mean, it's always been problematic before in terms of like who really makes decisions on these issues. But now it's really muddied the water with this many people involved. And Chris Christie, though, to his credit, I mean, he's been terrible on so many aspects of drug law enforcement and a real drug warrior, especially wanting to reignite the war on pot. And he said if he ever became attorney general, that'd be the law of the land again. He would, you know, restart that war on pot and exert federal supremacy. But on the opioid issue, he has listened to harm reductionists in New Jersey, at least. But again, we have so many chefs trying to cook this soup, and it's going to turn out to be kind of a real mess if they don't coordinate.
What was the Obama administration's overall approach to drug policy?
On some areas, I think in terms of harm reduction, overdose prevention, drug treatment, they've been very, very good. I think they deserve a lot of credit for that. On other aspects, particularly internationally, I think there's a lot more criticism that could be leveled against them. And also in terms of marijuana domestically, they've had a position of basically benign neglect. That is to say, they would let states legalize marijuana provided they met certain conditions, that there are strong state regulatory mechanisms, that they're not, you know, selling to traffickers or minors, that sort of thing, or crossing state lines. And so if those things are in place, then the Obama administration, you know, quite rightly said, look, we have other priorities. There are a zillion laws on the books. And yes, we can theoretically enforce all of them, but that's impossible to do. And we'd rather go after violent criminals and things of higher importance than going after legal, regulated, taxed marijuana dispensaries.
And that's likely to be very different under Attorney General Jeff Sessions, right?
Yeah, Sessions is a real old school culture warrior and a hardline right winger going back decades. And his worldview is really fixed in time back in the 1980s in so many ways, not just on drugs, but also on race and other issues. And so he's a real throwback. But on the other hand, you've got other people in the administration that are thinking politically and realizing that, you know, marijuana, each time it comes to the public in elections, does better than, you know, in 2012, it outperformed Obama and Mitt Romney in California, in Colorado and Washington State. Same with the last election. It beats our presidential candidates of both parties. So woe unto the politician that thinks they can overturn this. It reminds me a lot of same-sex marriage in the Supreme Court, right? The Supreme Court was loath to overturn it, in part because of a doctrine or a principle somewhat obscure. It's called the normative power of the actual. That is to say that when people have gotten certain rights and they've exercised them and consider them a norm, they've entered into lifelong commitments, into business contracts, bought real estate together, all kinds of legal entanglements. Woe unto the politician or Supreme Court justice who thinks they can overturn all of that, because it's at this point extremely difficult, both in terms of same-sex marriage and marijuana businesses.
The Trump administration keeps asserting that it's going to tackle the opioid crisis. What levers are actually at its disposal to help stop this problem?
Well, first, you have to have a vision of you know, understanding why the crisis came about, and then having a clear, coherent set of actions to confront the problem. That, I think, is completely missing at this point. And it starts at the top. So when you have the president saying that, you know, we're going to build a wall and that's going to solve the heroin problem in the United States, that's just fantasy from the beginning, number one. And then we can talk about the law enforcement and domestic, you know, applications of that later. But let's just take to the wall for a moment. That he's really tripled down on this wall idea. If the wall actually worked, which I don't think it will, and I think it's going to be counterproductive in so many ways, but if it worked at stopping a significant amount of heroin, what's going to happen? it's utterly, utterly predictable that what's causing the vast amount of overdose deaths right now isn't the heroin by itself, and it isn't prescription opioids by themselves, though they can be deadly. But they're just as deadly as they were 10, 20 years ago. Right? Nothing has changed about those particular drugs. What's killing people today is the adulteration of street heroin with fentanyl, and it's even many, many times more potent a cousin, carfentanil. And either of these substitute opioids are so toxic that they can kill you with just 4 granules of salt worth of fentanyl can kill you. And just a tiny amount of dust of carfentanil, which is used as elephant tranquilizer, will kill you dead. And so traffickers and dealers are obtaining these synthetic opioids overseas, very often through mail order. Because they're so potent, they can be mailed in tiny little packages, smuggled in all kinds of legitimate commerce, and it gets through our borders right away. And they've been mixing that into the heroin to stretch the profits, to make it go farther, which is what they want to do. They're in it for the money. They're maximizing profits. And so if this wall actually worked, they're going to put a lot more fentanyl to stretch whatever heroin they have left to stretch their profits. And that is going to cause a huge uptick in overdose deaths, in my opinion. So it's backwards from the start.
And it's not that there's so much demand from addicts that fentanyl is such a hedonic, wonderful drug from their perspective, is it? Or is
it
mostly the manufacturers?
No, it's a terrible drug, actually. If anything, it tends to put you right out rather than letting them enjoy their quote-unquote high. But I was prescribed fentanyl last year. I had a couple of surgeries. I didn't even know until afterwards they'd given me fentanyl. But it worked. It did knock me right out, and I have no memory of the surgery. But when you mix it in and these, black market dealers, it has to be done very, very, very precisely. Otherwise, you get batches of heroin that have very widely varying potencies, and that's what's killing people. Nobody uses heroin. They don't buy heroin in the street with the intention of overdosing. No one wants to do that. But because it's unregulated and it's adulterated in the black market, you don't know if you're getting, traditional 7% pure heroin or 70% pure or something that's been adulterated with fentanyl, which is 50 times more powerful than heroin.
Is it true that that fentanyl and carfentanil are now so potent or in such large supply that it's interfering with the ability of standard issue naloxone to reverse an overdose?
Yes, exactly. So fentanyl can sometimes require several doses of naloxone to revive someone, whereas heroin is just one dose and you'll survive. And with carfentanil, which is about 100 times more powerful than fentanyl itself, I mean, it's an insanely powerful drug. That is showing up now in our domestic heroin supply. And that has taken, in some cases, several doses of naloxone to revive someone in an overdose. In fact, if you talk to veterinarians, the people who actually go out into the bush to tranquilize elephants and that sort of thing, or buffalo, the safety protocols for using carfentanil as a veterinarian are so strict. You have to have multiple vials of antidote handy. You have to contact emergency services in your local area in case there's an accident or you ingest just a tiny amount of it. So it's insanely powerful. People, some of your older listeners may remember back in 2002 in Moscow, there was that Chechen terrorist laid siege to a theater in Moscow, right? And they had took hundreds of hostages. And Russian special forces went in there and they used a gas. And it was an aerosolized form of carfentanil. And that gas was supposed to knock everyone out in the theater. It ended up killing over 100 of the hostages. That's how powerful this stuff is. So you get a sense of how difficult it is to dose this stuff correctly.
What's the solution now that this technological genie's out of the bottle, that we've got this incredibly potent, easily smugglable, very lethal substance running around in the black market? How do we pull back from that?
Yeah, so, the knee-jerk response from the DEA and these other law enforcement types is that we need to clamp down on supply and over-prescribing and that sort of thing. Well, they should have done that 2 decades ago when this problem was first beginning. And it's important to trace this back to the origins because that gives us some clue of how to solve this or how to begin to address it. And that is to say, back in 1996, when OxyContin first came on the market, the manufacturer Purdue Pharma engaged in what I consider very scandalous behavior. The Los Angeles Times last year did a wonderful multi-part series on this history of Purdue Pharma and how they marketed OxyContin to doctors, saying this new time release formulation is so much safer. You don't have to worry about addiction. You can prescribe it, you know, for all kinds of minor things, long-term pain, so on and so forth. And also internally, they knew that this time release formula, which they claimed would last 12 hours, would not last the full 12 hours. And so people who prescribed this stuff were going to begin taking more of it much sooner than was prescribed. And they knew that they would build up this, you know, terrible cycle of dependency. And I've known lots of people who, you know, wrestled with dependency on OxyContin. And so at that point, it was the same point where in 1997, the United States first began direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs on television. It began with Bob Dole and his famous Viagra ad, right? And yeah. Before that, pharmaceutical companies thought, oh, if you listed all the side effects, no one will buy any of these drugs. Well, the Viagra turned out to be a blockbuster. And over the decades, we have learned to tune out the second two-thirds of the ad, you know, when they list all the complications and side effects of these drugs.
Right? They call that the fair balance. I used to work in pharma advertising.
Uh-huh. And we've learned to
and it was
it
a pain to proofread all those lines.
Exactly. But and I'm not saying they advertise opioids over the air. No. But what it has done, however, is created an entire generation of kids who have been brought up in what I call pill culture, that there is a pill for every problem. Talk to your doctor. If it's prescribed by a doctor on a prescription pad, it comes in a blister pack, was manufactured in a factory by people in lab coats, it must somehow be safe. Otherwise, the government wouldn't allow these things to happen, would they? Well, in fact, a lot of these opioids and other drugs are extremely powerful. And if you mix them with alcohol or other drugs, they can kill you just as quick as street drugs. And so we've had this culture of now of normalizing pills for every occasion or inconvenience rather than changing lifestyles or diet or anything else.
And it's not going to put the genie back in the bottle, like you're saying, that, you know, cutting off prescribing now, prescribing has been dropping since 2012, and cutting it back further is probably not going to address those underlying attitudes.
Exactly. And so Canada has had a horrible time with fentanyl. So many overdoses in Vancouver and British Columbia especially, and they are moving forward with prescription heroin so that, and it's only for the most severe cases of people who have failed at all other treatment modalities. You know, methadone didn't work and Suboxone and all these other things didn't work, abstinence didn't work, and you're still addicted and intent on using heroin, then the government can step in and say, look, we'd rather you stop, but if you're absolutely incapable of stopping, we don't want you to go back to the street into the black market to buy this adulterated stuff that could just as easily kill you. And instead, we're going to provide you with a pharmaceutically pure known dose of, you know, a consistent dose so that you don't have to worry about going into withdrawal. It won't be enough to get you for you to chase the dragon to get higher and higher, but it'll keep you from going into withdrawal, which is what most people are afraid of. And at that point, you know, you can maintain someone in a healthy, relatively healthy life for decades. You know, some of the earliest people who were addicted to heroin were doctors because they had access to it for so many decades. And so we know that the long-term use is not that physiologically damaging other than constipation. Psychologically, it can be damaging in other ways, et cetera. But if it's pure, it's not as dangerous as what you buy on the street.
Do you think that there's any future for selective enforcement, essentially saying to large-scale drug dealers or letting it be known that, you know, if your shipment is all heroin, we're going to go after you less than if your shipment contains any traces of fentanyl or carfentanil?
Yeah, all enforcement is selective, in my opinion, right? Because we have a zillion laws on the books, and in theory, the federal government can enforce all those federal laws if they chose to. But no one in the world has those kinds of resources, nor would the public put up with, you know, every little jaywalking enforcement or whatever. And so that's what the Obama administration recognized. And they do the same with deportations, by the way, with DACA and other things. They say, look, we got other priorities here. The people who committed violent crimes or other things, this is the lowest priority. You can extend that to the macro level, to some of these more problematic substances as well, because you have limited resources as a government and you have to decide who you're going to go after. And if it were up to me, I would go after the most problematic violators, not simply going after the little fish or trying to, you know, round up as many prosecutions as you can to build a record for which you can run for higher office later. those kinds of arrests and prosecutions, they're good for police departments, they're good for prosecutors in terms of building up their tough reputations, but in fact, those enforcement patterns can often make the problem worse.
What about medication-assisted treatment, you know, short of prescription heroin, but things like methadone and buprenorphine? Is there a place for that in the Trump administration's drug policy?
We'll see. We'll see what influence Chris Christie or others have. But if it's, you know, someone like Tom Marino, the drug czar nominee, or Jeff Sessions, boy, I mean, that's going to be a tough sell. I think they're so retrograde in their views on these issues.
It's ironic because federal health authorities recognize methadone as the gold standard treatment for people with heroin addiction because it drops the death rate so much.
Yeah.
And then other federal agencies are saying, no, we can't have it.
Yeah. And especially, you know, for so many decades, we've been advocating all kinds of things, with, you know, in terms of needle exchange, in terms of various harm reduction measures. The DEA has historically fought us each step of the way. Under the Obama administration, the drug czar, while he wouldn't publicly use the term harm reduction, allowed a lot of the principles of harm reduction to take effect. And it would be a really stupid reversal if the Trump administration tried to roll that back. That's the direction Canada and European nations and many other countries are headed. And it's a much more enlightened response to this problem than prohibition and more law enforcement.
I grew up in Canada, and one of the most annoying things was whenever we'd have a step forward on drug policy, the U.S. would rant and rave and threaten to destroy our exports. Do you think the U.S. is going to do that again this time around, use its clout to enforce its more reactionary drug policy agenda?
Well, in terms of international driving the drug war internationally, everything changed in 2012 when Colorado and Washington State, where the voters were given a free choice, and they resoundingly, you know, chose to reverse gears on the drug war, particularly with regard to cannabis. And at that point, it became much harder for our State Department to twist arms overseas. And in fact, for about 2 years, they kept their mouth shut because they didn't know what to say. They hadn't formulated their internal coherent policy yet. And so the Latin America, you know, attorney generals and diplomats would say to our State Department, they would ask, so what's your new policy going to be now that your own citizens are beginning to legalize these drugs? You know, are you going to continue to force us to maintain these draconian policies? And all they could do is smile and say, we're still working on it, you know, until they finally unveiled the Obama doctrine of tolerating states legalization.
If the border wall were to be built against all odds, what would the other results be in terms of drugs coming in? How would cartels respond besides gravitating towards more concentrated and deadly products?
Yeah, they've already responded. And so the countermeasures are already in place, which is something that Trump is oblivious to. So the idea that building a wall, no matter how high it is not going to, it's not possible or feasible in terms of just the physics of it. Trump wants a solid wall, for instance, and by some accounts, 30 feet high. Well, if you've ever been in a desert and experienced a flash flood, the idea of putting a wall in the middle of that, the power of a flash flood, is just mind-boggling. Right now, we have lots of fencing, 700 miles or so of fencing along that border, and they have 4-inch gaps in the fence. And that's to let wildlife and seeds and sand and water to go through it. And it's also for the safety of our own Border Patrol. So the Border Patrol themselves do not want a solid wall because it's dangerous for them. They want a wall they can see through so they can see if people are amassing on the other side, planning some kind of breakthrough or attack or ambush or whatever. So for their own safety, they're saying this is a dumb idea. Now, let's suppose this wall is built. Well, the countermeasures have been in place for a long time. So one of the first reactions from the drug traffickers when the fence went up was to build ramps on flatbed trucks. So they literally drive a truck up to the fence, and there are photos you can see on the web of them driving SUVs literally over the fence and coming down the other side.
So there would be those, like, two rails for the tires to go on, so
exactly,
go up and then
exactly
down again on the other side?
Exactly. And so, you know, if we get better at stopping those, then there's the old, you know, they go retro, Roman technology, catapults. They're literally building catapults to fling bales of drugs over that wall. If you build a higher wall, they've already got a backup plan, which is pneumatic air cannons. People are familiar with t-shirt cannons in sports stadiums and that sort of thing. These are souped-up versions of that. They mount them in the back of pickup trucks, and they have air compressors that can launch huge bales of drugs over that wall like a mortar. And if we get an even higher wall, then there's already a plan B, which is ultralights. They used to use small aircraft, and they used to use, you know, old airliners on their last legs for one-way missions. And more recently, they've adapted and used ultralight aircraft, which are slow. They can carry a couple hundred pounds of payload in a drop cage, and they can go over the wall but under the radar. But even though we're getting better at detecting those, there's yet another backup plan for the aerial route, which is drones. And so for high-value drugs like methamphetamine or heroin or cocaine, that's a very practical application because you don't need a huge payload. So that's the air route. On the sea route, they've been evolving for decades as well. So they used to use fishing boats and shrimp boats and hide their drugs in seafood shipments. Then they moved to cigarette boats or speed boats, and we got faster, and Coast Guard got faster vessels. And so then they adapted and switched to semi-submersibles, which are quasi-submarines that remain 90% underwater. And those can move, you know, 6 to 12 tons per shipment. And they lie still during the day, and they throw a blue tarp over themselves, and they just lie still. They travel by night. And as one DE agent put it, he said, look, you try finding something the size of a log floating in the Pacific Ocean. That's how difficult it is to stop this. But nonetheless, we got better at detecting those semi-submersibles. So the traffickers are now building fully functional, proper submarines that can dive up to 50 feet below water. Those are really hard to detect. And again, they can move up to 10, 12 tons at a time. And there's an even more ingenious innovation after that, which is narco torpedoes. So they've got these pods that can either be bolted underneath the ship and released if they're stopped and searched, or they can be towed with a long, long cable. It can be hundreds of meters long. And so if you stop those vessels, they just simply release the cable, and there's nothing to find. Meanwhile, the pod, or the narco torpedo, has a homing beacon on it that's encoded, and it's instructed to surface every couple of hours and admit its location to the backup ship that's, you know, miles, miles behind it, and they'll pick up the payload. And then on the land route, there's underground, so narco tunnels. There are hundreds of narco tunnels crisscrossing the border. We found maybe 100 of them, and they're incredibly sophisticated. They've got rail systems, ventilation, electricity, and those, once they're open, can move tons and tons per week of drugs 24/7, and including moving money and guns and ammunition back the other direction.
What percentage of illicit drugs in the U.S. came over the southern border to begin with? And then of those, what percentage came in illicitly, as opposed to just through the regular ports of entry?
Yeah, it's hard to say because these are guesstimates by the governments. I mean, you can only catch what you catch. You can't see what you can't catch. But suffice it to say that very little of it comes in the overland route, which is what Trump has in mind. What he talks about, and Congressman Steve King and these other people, you know, talking about, you know, these migrants with the calves the size of cantaloupes, you know, they're schlepping a couple of kilos of drugs because the coyotes, the traffickers, you know, force them to carry drugs while they smuggle the humans. That's peanuts. You're talking about kilos at that point, and I'm talking about tons. Hundreds of tons of drugs. That's where they're coming through in terms of the narco submarines, in terms of the tunnels, in terms of most of those drugs are coming through legal checkpoints on the border. Okay. They're not bypassing the wall. They're not trying to go around the wall or over the wall or under the wall. They're going through the wall legally. And so there's an X prize, if you will. If you can find a better way to hide drugs in vehicles, whether it's 18 wheelers or SUVs or passenger vehicles, so that's what they're doing. And they're playing this incredible cat and mouse game. And you can see presentations by Border Patrol, or Customs on all the ingenious ways they found people have been able to carve out compartments and ways to smuggle and ship legal shipments. So they're coming right through legal ports of entry that a wall will not stop.
Should we worry that if we really tighten up the illicit channels over the border, we're more at risk for corruption through the illicit channels? I mean, that people will start bribing people rather than sneaking drugs?
So how are these so many vehicles getting through these legal checkpoints right now? Some of it is because they're ingenious, and some of it's because they've bribed people on both sides of the border to let certain vehicles pass through. And so the Border Patrol has a big problem with corruption. Now they want to push the surge in hiring and taking all kinds of shortcuts in terms of background checks for these employees. And basically, if you build a huge wall, you're going to create a funnel to these legal checkpoints. And the people who are corrupt right now and making money, they're going to have even more business being funneled through their pockets, so to speak.
And it seems like it's also just a numbers game that, you know, you can't search every vehicle going through the checkpoint because so much commerce goes in and out, so much legitimate travel,
exactly,
that it's always going to be a stochastic thing, even if you're totally honest.
Exactly. So this is the fallacy that the drug war is, you know, based upon, that somehow we can seal our borders that'll keep drugs out. We've got thousands of miles of border. We've got thousands of miles of shoreline and over 300 legal ports of entry. And you can't possibly police all of that. We don't inspect all the cargo that comes into this country. We profile it. We inspect a small percentage of it. And so it's always going to come through. But what comes through is very important, because if we do stop a lot of the heroin or traditional drugs, these far more dangerous synthetic substitutes are more powerful, more diabolical, and have more unintended consequences, and are much more dangerous in many ways. And those are so powerful and concentrated, you can smuggle them in very tiny packages. So I mentioned carfentanil earlier, the elephant tranquilizer. That's insanely powerful. And the way it comes through in the mail very often, these postal packages, is not that it's smuggled inside a cell phone part or anything, or you know, electronics or whatever. No, it's smuggled inside the silica gel packs, the things you usually throw away, right? And the traffickers will inform their buyers. There'll be, you know, 4 silica packs in this shipment. One of them will have a tiny red dot in one corner. That's where you find the carfentanil. So imagine having customs stop every package that comes through this country to look for a tiny red dot that might give some indication. I mean, this is just ludicrous. And so we take a problem that's bad and make it worse.
Has anybody been killed? Police officers or postal employees or anybody else been killed by loose carfentanil? Because I can't imagine it's always perfectly packaged.
It is a very serious hazard for them. So even just a little bit of dust can be very, very dangerous. So this is quite hazardous. But again, these are problems of our own making. Users on the street don't want to use carfentanil. They don't want to use fentanyl, and they certainly don't want to use carfentanil. But that's what dealers are cutting their shipments with now because of you know, the rush to profits.
That's all the time we have for now. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Now it's time for Recommended Reading, our weekly feature that helps you put current events in context. Our first selection is an investigation by Nick Penzenstadler and his team at USA Today. Recently, on The Breach, Zephyr Teachout explained why the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the Constitution prohibits the president from accepting payments from foreign governments. The USA Today team spent 4 months compiling a list of Trump properties for sale, a 400-unit, $250 million real estate portfolio. And when these units sell, the proceeds go directly to the Trump Organization, which is controlled by Trump's sons, and which Trump can tap for cash whenever he wants. Any foreign government seeking to curry favor with Trump could overpay, and nobody would ever know if they used a shell company to hide their identity. That's why we need to see his tax returns. Our second pick is a piece by Ryan Lizza in The New Yorker entitled, "The White House Seems Excited to Shut Down the Government." Lizza succinctly explains how Trump and his budget director engineered a hostage scenario over Obamacare, where funding for the federal government hangs in the balance. That's it for Recommended Reading. The Breach is produced by Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Valetti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, BEYERSTEIN, on Twitter. See you next week.